Hi there. This is Brent.
And this is Amanda.
We are the Unreliable Narrators.
Here to talk about the strangeness, the mystery, and the wonder of Gene Wolfe's prose.
What is time?
What is memory?
What is a person?
Is this reality?
Where are we?
Do we exist?
Have you ever considered that all your choices are what have brought you right here to this very moment?
Episode number 14, The Monday Man. First published in the ReaderCon 3 anthology in 1990, and then later collected in Innocence Aboard.
Yes. This is a fun one.
Yeah. What's a Monday man, Brent?
Monday man is somebody who, back before we had dryers.
Wait, there was a time before dryers?
Yeah. People used to hang their clothes out on a clothesline to dry.
So what's a clothesline? Is that a line that you put clothes on?
Yep. Well done with your etymology.
Oh, boy. Okay. Deductive reasoning for the win. Okay, so in time before dryers.
Yeah, and they would go out and steal women's clothes off the clothesline.
Specifically women's clothes, huh?
Yeah, basically underwear.
So. Oh, lovely. Okay. So everyone had to hang their clothes out to dry in the sunshine, and then people would steal certain things.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Monday, because Monday is washing day.
Yeah.
If you read Little House on the Prairie, you would know that.
You say that, and then I'm like, well, one of my grandmas was very much on the, yeah, Monday's washing day.
And Tuesday's ironing.
Must have been a cultural thing.
Must have been. I mean, now with, you know, washers and dryers and it all being an easier chore, laundry is every couple of days I run a load or two and then fold it.
It's like my grandpa used to say, everybody reminiscing about the good old days, he doesn't remember them there as they were living through it.
Right.
Yeah, so things are better. The front matter from Innocence Aboard.
Yes.
It has some comments in there. Monday men were a perennial problem for my poor mother.
Oh, so Mrs. Wolf, Mama Wolf, had to deal with Monday men.
Yeah. There's also in the sorcerer's house, there's Nicholas the butler. There's a comment in there about how he's a laundry thief. As far as I remember, it doesn't specifically say he's a Monday man.
But he steals laundry.
Yeah, he steals laundry. And I think the implication is that he's a Monday man.
Yeah, and it is kind of interesting to think about how much culture has shifted, because the idea of my laundry being out in public seems kind of shocking to me. And yet I did grow up, I mean, the first washer that my family had was an old wringer washer.
Mm-hmm.
And so doing laundry was a bit of a chore. Like, you load it into the tub and it agitates it. And then, and there was no lid on the tub. So it splashes around a bit. And you manually add the soap. And then you run it through the wringer, which is attached to the side of the washer, and then hang it on the line. And so that's what we did when I was a child, when I was a young child. And then later we got a regular washer and dryer, but we often used a clothesline just because it was less expensive not to use the electricity.
Yeah.
And then many times in my childhood, we lived in a place that didn't have a washer and dryer. And so we went to a laundromat every week. And that's a bit of a production too, and feels like a very public thing. And now I just take it for granted that, you know, my laundry goes from my hamper in my bedroom to my washer dryer in my bathroom and then back. And it never sees public eye.
Yeah. I remember my dad's mom. She had a wringer that went in the sink. Now, this is when I was very little, but that's how she did washing too. And then boiling the water in the kettle and pouring it in the sink and then running the little hand crank.
Oh, a hand crank wringer.
Yeah.
It's safer than the electric one that we had. You're less likely to get caught by it, but so much more work.
Yeah. So another thing on what you said. with clotheslines, and this is an issue that comes up. So one, you mentioned they use less electricity, and this is something, I don't even know what you like, green movement or just like money savings or, hey, maybe we shouldn't just burn through the environment of Earth like movement, whichever.
What a radical you are.
Yeah. But most HOAs in the U.S. outlaw, well, not outlaw, but they
will ban from,
they ban your ability to have a clothesline, even in the backyard.
Yeah, a lot of cities have passed ordinances that homeowners associations cannot ban clotheslines. One more strike against homeowners associations, and they already had enough strikes against them.
Yeah, I think they're the single biggest ill that has been created thus far in this point in human history.
That's a bold statement.
And I'm willing to back it up.
All right. Should we get into that now, or should we go back to the Monday Man?
Oh, we'll do another podcast on that.
Okay.
So there is some introductory material in the ReaderCon 3 anthology.
Tell me about that.
Robert Colby, he credits the book of The New Sun with rekindling his love of reading. And the way he says it is that his love of reading had been smothered by aesthetic conservatism. The genre of science fiction and fantasy had just become stale. And so he had started reading when all these new authors were trying new and different things. And then he got burnt out on reading because he was just seeing imitations of everything being published.
Stylistically, things just were ossifying.
Yeah. Yeah. And okay. So he read Book of the New Sun, and that reignited his love of reading and his imagination. And so Wolf was actually the first ReaderCon guest of honor. And so Robert Colby was instrumental in putting that together. Of note, there's a Esther Freisner short story, Articles of Faith, also included in this anthology.
Oh, interesting. Esther Freisner, that name sounds vaguely familiar.
It does. There's also a short story, Going to the Mountain, by Daryl Schweitzer.
Yes.
Yeah, so he may be of interest for readers of Wolf. He has an interview in Speaking of the Fantastic, Volume 2. And there's a Wolf interview in there, and then also a Peter S. Beagle and R.A. Lafferty and others.
So those are some good names.
Yeah. He also was an editor, along with Martin Greenberg, for Full Moon City. And that's a werewolf short story anthology that contains, at least at the time of this recording, an uncollected short story by Wolf, and that's Innocent.
So nice.
That's all the front-loaded material there.
Yeah, that's the milieu in which The Monday Man was published. Well, I like that introduction that acknowledges how revolutionary the Book of the New Sun is as a reading experience. I think it's most people's gateway drug to Wolf. It was certainly our gateway drug to Wolf. And that feeling he described of, I would call it the re-enchantment of reading. It's something that's happened to me a number of times. I don't think I've ever been genuinely disenchanted with reading, but certainly have gone through some troughs where finding something that is startling, interesting, and stimulating has been difficult.
Yeah.
And I do remember the first experience of reading the Book of the New Sun being one of just perpetual astonishment. What is happening? I'm so overwhelmed and delighted. And that's one of the great reading experiences. Certainly, I love going back to old favorites and reading and rereading them. And now, of course, I expect to be astonished when I pick up Wolf. But that first time, it's wonderful.
Yeah. I wish I could repeat it in many ways, but...
What, the first time through Wolf?
Yeah.
Yeah. But then, you know, we wouldn't be at the point of podcasting about him.
That's true.
What I want, and the experience I keep looking for, even through many disappointments, is finding a new author that can do that for me as well.
Yeah. So, Monday Man.
Yeah, the Monday Man. It starts out first person narration. We'll just call the narrator Wolf or Gene.
Yeah, it's, well, Gene is.
Yeah.
I mean, right off the bat, we have another. I've been calling them wolf gimmicks. I don't know if like that sounds dismissive, but I guess wolf tricks of the trade.
Tropes,
authorial
habits.
It starts off first person, and it's the narrator is a Gene.
Yeah, and this is a Gene who became a lawyer.
Yeah. So if there was a fate worse than being a mystery writer, maybe a lawyer.
Yeah. Yeah. Darkest timeline. Yeah. And he's friends with someone that he grew up with at the old Harry S. Truman School. And this friend's name is John Gennaro. And he and John get together and talk. And John eventually starts sharing a very formative experience early in his police career, because John's become a policeman.
And they're talking and drinking.
As one does.
Yeah. And this is the, he only brings this up once, and then we'll never answer questions about it later.
Yes.
I was still a rookie, he said, and it hit me harder than anything has since. Though I've had a partner shot down beside me, and I was the one that opened the box they'd pushed the Rothman girl in. And then that's where we get the question, know what a Monday man is, Gene? I didn't. And John kept talking.
Yeah. And then he explains what we've just talked to death is that you hung your laundry out in public, and then sometimes people would steal stuff.
Yeah. So we get the sense here that this is a story that takes place in a different time, because he's out walking a beat. Most cops that I see they're either in vehicles or on motorcycles.
Or very occasionally on bikes.
Yeah.
But that's only in very specific circumstances. But officers are almost exclusively in a vehicle or on a vehicle and not out walking a beat. And maybe this is, we don't live in an extremely large city. Maybe that's more common in larger cities where there's the greater population density, but I still don't see or hear of that.
From my understanding, most policing in the U.S. has gone away from having officers out walking, and it has been a push in the last decade, at least, maybe a bit more, to get away from an officer being in a car, but an officer being somebody out that's in the community.
Yeah, trying to move back toward that more neighborhood policing model.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he's out walking a beat, and then he sees someone running with a pair of overalls in his hand. So not women's underwear this time.
Yep.
So a small man running off with overalls and a woman yelling that he stole them.
Yeah. And so he goes off to find this person. This is the point in the story where we start getting it grows more in here, but we start getting a sense that he's not in what would be considered a good neighborhood.
Yeah.
People are hesitant to interact with him where he's a law enforcement officer. Like, I get the sense that the lady almost didn't want to come to him, but like, while he calls all this stuff very petty larceny, the fact that she had something stolen, to her, it's not petty. It's probably a sizable amount of money.
Right. If you're living that close to the line, you know, replacing a significant article of clothing would be a big deal.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then you get another hint, which is that he chases the guy and loses track of him. And then some kid who's been in trouble with the law before tells him which way the guy ran. And that was its own little mini drama of this kid speaking to the police officer when he'd been in trouble with the law before, maybe trying to get a little goodwill.
And that's how I read that too.
Yeah. And then he starts running up the stairs of the building where the man's disappeared into.
Yeah. So the man went into some apartment buildings. And so he's thinking that by the time he got there, he's locked himself into one of the apartments. So he's going around knocking on the door with his Billy and yelling police.
And he gets all the way to the top. And then the guy didn't open the door. So the officer kicks the door in.
Yep.
Which is surprisingly difficult to do unless, you know, the wood is old and dry and a little bit rotten, in which case make sure that you kick close to where the latch is.
Yep.
Otherwise, you're just wasting your energy.
Mm-hmm. So this man, he was just standing in the middle of the room with the overalls still in his hand. I figured he'd been looking for a place to hide them and couldn't find one, because that was about as bare as a room as you could find. So there's an empty bottle on the floor and a closet, and that was all there was except for the guy himself.
Yeah, says he's ordinary looking, wearing an old sport coat that's too big for him.
Yeah, which I think the implication there is the police officers thinking that's probably also another stolen item.
Yes. And so he yells, "You're under arrest," grabs the guy's arm with his left hand just above the cuff. And that's what saved me, even though I didn't know it then, even now, or every once in a while, I still dream about it. And then with his right hand, he snaps handcuffs over both wrists and tells him to come along.
Yeah, and both of our wrists.
Yeah, so he cuffs the guy to himself.
Yeah, which is another thing that you would not see a police officer doing today.
Right, yeah, that's not so much the method. Maybe they read the story and learned, because this is going very poorly. He tries to drag the guy out of the apartment, and the guy just bulks, digs his heels in.
Mm-hmm. And not only that, but he jerked so hard on the cuffs that he pulled the officer off his feet.
Right. And so he tries to drag him down the stairs. They get partway down, and then he drags him back up, and he gets mad about it and hits him with the billy club.
Yeah. Told him to cut it out. His knees gave a little and he stopped pulling, but he never said a word.
Yeah. And he says, "I'd have sworn there wasn't a man alive that could drag me up a flight of stairs if I didn't want to go. But here was this little guy who didn't look like he weighed 140. Doing it."
So along the way, we're getting interjections between John and Jean.
Right, so, asking questions.
Yeah, and John, he rubbed the white scars on his knuckles reflexively. So this is where he had punched the guy on the jaw.
Yeah, I pasted him one on the jaw. That ought to have broken it. But it didn't? No, but he stopped pulling. You want to shove that bottle over a little? Yep. So John's ready for another drink at this point in the narrative.
And then this is the first point in the story where we start getting kind of our hints that maybe things aren't what they actually look like. So John says, "The funny thing was that my fist stayed right on his chin. You ever touch a piece of bare metal that's been in a freezer? It was just like that, except he didn't feel cold. It was like when you get crazy glue on your fingers, except we didn't have crazy glue then. I tried to shake my hand loose and couldn't. All it did was hurt."
Yeah, and we just got that line about him rubbing scars on his knuckles, and now it seems like we're finding out where the scars came from. Also, I'm sorry, but this is such a Southern person's description. Touch a piece of bare metal that's been in a freezer. Because anyone from the northern part of the United States would say, "Did you ever touch a piece of bare metal outside in the wintertime?"
Yep.
Have you? It is a peculiar burning sensation.
It is. And the other thing, too, is depending on your hand, it's also going to stick to it.
And any hint of moisture to your hand.
Yeah. Then you can be dumb and try to jerk it away, or you wait a moment.
Your body heat should warm it up. Now, this is where that stupid movie that everybody talks about, where the kid licks the flagpole, mm-hmm, at the school. I can't ever remember a time when I would have been so foolish to be like, "I wonder what will happen if I lick an ice cold metal pole in the middle of wintertime." I feel like that is, I mean, maybe kids did that, but 4 years old out on the farm and you've picked up a cold shovel handle before, and you've touched, I don't know, a fence post, you know, a metal fence post, and you noticed.
Yeah.
I would think.
Yeah, and I think there's where your difference is, because I'm guessing that these are mostly urban kids that are inside, or suburban urban areas.
Right.
Where most of their experience is inside a building and not outside.
Right. They're not out there with the axe chopping wood in the wintertime.
I do remember a few childhood friends doing that, but that was when we were living in a city.
Right. Not your rural aspect. All right. So he needs another drink because he's talking about how his hand got stuck to this guy's jaw. And then he really looks at this Monday man. "He was such an ordinary little bum that I hadn't paid any more attention to him than I would to one particular match in a folder. I had his face turned up so I could see my knuckles, and I noticed his nostrils," as one does.
I'll come back around to this later, but I think that this is an important part here, too. because we have John acting in his role as a law enforcement officer, going after this man that the lady flagged him down for. And he is not, in one sense, he's not operating from human to human, which I understand, because he's in a heightened situation where he's an officer going after a criminal. But this is the point where it's like, oh yeah, because he's got the nostrils, but then it's like his eyes, it's like they were, what does it say? They should have been two little black depressions. His eyes were just the same way. They didn't have any depth. So it's his nostrils and eyes are painted. And so then the question that Gene asks, in other words, your Monday man had on a mask, and John shook his head. A mask in someplace. It was more like he was a dummy, like they would have had in a department store. Only I've never seen one half as good as he was.
Yeah, so he's been chasing this guy down, and he slapped cuffs on his wrist, and it's just now, after a pretty intense struggle and then a punch that doesn't work right, that he really starts to pay attention and recognizes the fact that he had just been treating him like a generic, you know, a generic bum, mm-hmm. a member of a category. And then as soon as he starts to pay attention, he realizes this guy is somehow artificial.
Yeah. So they get in a pulling match. And
yes,
he was able to drag him clear down to the first floor, but he almost loses ground once or twice. But then he starts getting reeled in.
Yeah. Kicked at his feet as we went upstairs. So he drug him all the way down and he's yelling, but nobody comes to his help because in a bad neighborhood, nobody will help the police officer.
Mm-hmm.
And then he pulls him back upstairs. The Monday man pulls him back upstairs, even though the police officer, well, John, he kicks at his feet. He'd kicked him half a dozen times, you know, and he couldn't get the guy off balance.
Yeah. And that's when he starts thinking that maybe this guy's not the one moving.
Yeah.
He gets drugged back up into the room, and there's the door, and it says, this time the door that I thought probably belonged to a closet was standing wide open, but there wasn't a closet in back of it. It was black as an alderman's heart. I can see you're not buying a goddamn word of this. Well, I was about through drinking anyway.
Yeah, and you did skip over the part where he did get the key and got it in the lock of the cuffs, and so he was able to uncuff himself just before he sees that blackness, emptiness at the back of what should have been a closet.
I shouldn't have skipped that. That's actually a very
No, just the action there that he got himself unlocked. So now he has a hand free, the left hand. His right is still stuck to the guy's jaw. And he's telling Gene, you don't believe me.
Uh-huh. So he's got the handcuffs off, but his one hand is still stuck to the face where he punched him.
Right.
And so he's able to get his service revolver out and he fires into the closet.
Yes.
He's getting the sense that he's making all these references to bass lures and various other artificial baits. And he's in his heightened, oh crap, I'm going to die here, realizing this guy is not real. And so he shoots into the darkness, into the closet, because it's bigger than a small closet should be.
Yes. Yeah. And there's this sense of great horror about the closet, the darkness, that something is pulling him in and using the Monday man to do so.
Mm-hmm.
And even though he fires his gun into the closet, it seems to have no effect. The only thing that saves him is he rips his hand off of the jaw, leaving skin behind, and then is able to get away.
And then this is where he's like, yeah, this is why I never want to go fishing. And it ends with, but I keep wondering whether the fisherman, which is the presence that he identifies in the back of the closet, whether the fisherman ever uses live bait.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, this is a why I don't want to go fishing with you story. It turned into this happened when I was a rookie.
Yeah, and it is a genuinely horrifying story. I feel that sense of terror comes through the narrative so well.
Yeah.
because there's an accumulation of uncanny detail, inexplicable detail. And you're like, well, I mean, it would be scary to be a police officer in a bad neighborhood. And then you might end up in situations where you're not sure what you're getting into. But this is very, very much more than that, because if you touch this man, you're stuck to him, you're glued to him, mm-hmm. or frozen to him in some way. And something else, he's not the danger. Something yeah. else is trying to get you. And what is it?
Mm-hmm.
It's very Lovecraftian, but elegant.
It is. This is a difficult story to... There's not a lot of seams here in this story. I feel this is a story that is... You mentioned Lovecraft. But other than that, I can't point... Like, I can't point to, oh, yeah, this was an episode of Columbo that he saw, and then he mixed in... I don't know, something from Murder, She Wrote.
No, it much more feels like a whole piece of imagination.
Yeah. And then the twist at the end that kind of recontextualizes everything.
Yeah.
So I do have a comment here where
okay.
hopefully this will be a good springboard for the conversation. But when I read this, I knew that this was one of those stories that didn't have a lot of seams in it. It was a whole story, and either you got it or you didn't. There wasn't right. a lot to work through. There's a Wolf has some writing advice, and I had to look up where this was, but it's in the Best of Gene Wolfe on page 381, where he talks about if you want to write, pick a story that you like, and then rewrite that story. And, you know, lock the original away in a desk or a drawer, leave it at work, whatever. But then try to rewrite it as close as you could. And so this is one that I tried that with, just because it's so hard for me to see the seams and the construction with this. It's like, yes, we have a framing narrative and we're getting the story, but we're not actively in the story, but it's still a very creepy story. It's interesting because it's in my mind, oh, the horror was much, you know, I'd spend like a paragraph on it. And then when I would compare it, it's like, oh, he's got one line here.
Right. And that's the elegance that he put this together, and it is so tightly constructed. I like how you're describing it as the seams aren't visible, or even you can't even really feel them. It's only in trying to reconstruct it. You know, deconstructing it is hard, but mm-hmm. reconstructing it shows you not necessarily how Wolf did it, but how difficult and how deep in his craft he was.
Yeah. So another thing that I want to lay alongside that comment, in one sense, this reminds me of an O. Henry story or an O. Henry-esque story, where these stories' last line changes the way that you view the story.
This one's not as sweet as a lot of O. Henry stories are.
No. But there's also so I have been reading several of Damon Knight's short stories, because Damon Knight was, of course, that's where we get the famous "Groomy from a Bean" quote.
Yes.
And so I've been trying to go back and read some of his stuff. And some of his stuff, most of his stuff that I've read so far, personally, I don't feel it's aged as well. I think he was a better editor than he was an author, at least so far with what I've read. I haven't read all of his stuff, but he very much buys into the twist ending. And so I don't know if that was his preference or if that was the market's preference, because we get a lot of other stuff where it's like the Rod Sterling...
Twilight Zone.
Yeah. Sorry.
Okay.
Derp.
But I haven't actually watched any, but I knew the name.
Okay. The twist ending was a big thing. And obviously, maybe it's a different audience time. The premium on the twist ending usually doesn't do it for me. Here, it almost seems like Wolf took something like that, but then it's more fleshed out in a different way. Mm-hmm. And so we get this... Like, yeah, you could just be a guy going to work on Monday morning and some Lovecraftian whore decides that I don't even know what your lunch or your part of its game.
Yeah, and I like what you're saying there about the twist not doing it for you, but Wolf using a twist concept, but then he works it back through, I think, in a way that, so this is where it's easier to recognize genius or even to describe genius than to analyze it, right?
Okay.
So he is taking something that is conventional in a sense, and that is, oh, there's a twist at the end. The Monday man was bait the whole time. And then he plays with that enough and illuminates it enough in the course of the narrative that it doesn't feel like a twist ending. It feels like an unfolding flower might be a metaphor. I don't know, of unfolding flower of an eldritch horror. Seems an interesting juxtaposition, but twist, and then it's, well, yeah, but a twist is very simple. What if this was woven instead of twisted?
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm just throwing metaphors at Wolf's genius. I think that that is something of what's speaking here.
I think so. And so I've thought about this one quite a bit, and I came up with three.
What an interesting and significant number.
Well,
three what?
Yeah, three ideas. And okay. What I was going to say is, I was going back to your Why Private War poem.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so you had mentioned that Wolf's poem was one of the few that pointed outside of itself.
Oh, yes, in that collection.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And I think that while the seams are very tight, seamless, while the seams are seamless on this story, I think that it points to things above it. So the first one, there is a lot of cultural and political structures that are mentioned in this story, because we have class, we have, you know, there's a lawyer and there's a policeman. We get time with them, and we see that they're both honest in their own way, but they don't always see eye to eye. But then also we have them, you have a policeman arresting criminals, but then you have a lawyer defending them. And then you have his beat in a bad neighborhood. And there's just all the interaction with those things. And one of the things, and this is where I pointed out that he hadn't really paid attention to the bum. We're pretty far in the story before he realizes, oh, this isn't a man. This is something else. It's like if you view these political and cultural structures as something else, that it's like they cause ripples in the stream. So because all this is in like fishing metaphors in the story, if you've ever gone out fishing, transition zones are the areas where you would catch fish. And so at the ripples, the edge of the pools with the rapids.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so it's like the friction of these cultural and political structures is the area where this fisherman is able to operate in.
Well, and that then just invites reflection on your own cultural eddies, mm-hmm. or moments of friction. Like where is it where you bump up against that is strange and unknown? Or where is it where two forces in your life, two cultural or social forces, rub against one another? And what is... what can you fish for in those fruitful waters?
Yeah. To the second part, I was thinking about, because he makes a comment like, does the fisherman ever use live bait?
Yeah.
Usually when you use live bait, what you clip a fin or part of the tail. And so what ends up happening is the bait is struggling. And so it attracts
a predator.
Yeah.
Fish, larger predatory. Mm-hmm.
So then it's like there seems to be a suggestion that some people have been crippled in our society for purposes that it's like neither their purposes nor society's purposes. They're part of bait, so to speak.
Some fisherman is using them as live bait for something.
Yeah. And then the third...
That's disturbing and interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, and then the third...
I feel like someone needs to write a story about this.
If only somebody...
I know. If only someone would write sometimes.
And then the third one that I wanted to overlay here is there's a suggestion, one, that man has a predatory nature, but that nature's also balanced out with compassion and empathy and caring. And so you get the worry about live bait. So the things that in this particular case, there was a crime and you know, you have the police officer going in and there's like, yeah, it's a job. But yeah, also he's trying to protect the community in his own way.
Right, so there's concern for the woman, there's concern for the social good.
Yeah, and so it may not just be predatory, but there can also be compassion and empathy and caring that are being exploited by this supernatural fisherman that's over and above. He's in the closet where we can't see.
Right, he's somehow outside of our reality, but reaching into it.
Yeah.
Dropping his line in the water.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And but then so as an aspect of that, that compassion and humanity versus purely predatory nature, it is when John looks at the Monday man that he realizes that something is deeply wrong here. And so in that sense, it's him giving attention to the Monday man is the thing that begins to save him. I mean, he obviously has to rip his hand off and he has to fight really hard to get free, but it required him to be attentive to yeah. reality and not just assume, oh, he's just a generic bum, but actually see the person in front of him.
Mm-hmm. Like I'm imagining scenarios where, well, what a paramedic could drive up in an ambulance and somebody's bleeding out and it's like, oh, we got to, you know, put the pressure on and it, wait, why can't I remove my hand from the wound?
Right.
Or you have a psychiatrist that's like, wow, this person really has deep-seated trauma or mental issues. But then it's like you get psychiatrist who's trying to help get stuck. I'm using air quotes here because mentally or
right.
emotionally
trapped,
actually stuck and trapped. Mm-hmm. And so there's like all these weird marginal places that just don't. The class structures, the political structures, the friction between these different groups. And then if they're using live bait, yes, the attentiveness to the fact that, oh, this bum isn't a person, got the police officer in trouble. But then, oh, well, with live bait, that's a whole nother
It would
level.
Be a person. Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like the question there at the end, and this could just be me overlaying stuff that shouldn't be there, but how do you then go about discerning when somebody's harmed? But it's harmed by another being that's trying to use that person to get to others.
Right. Well, and I mean, in the fishing metaphor, when you catch the trout in order to catch the sturgeon has to want to eat the trout,
mm-hmm.
which is, yes, the circle of life, but we're human beings, not blindly out consuming or dominating, right? And
yeah.
so John is in the process of, you know, he has concern and compassion for the community and for the woman, but he also seems to be just kind of automatically slipping into the strong arm of the law, which may be interesting contrast to last episode with the game warden. But, you know, instantly he is cuffing the guy to himself, which seems a pretty aggressive. You know, it is petty larceny,
mm-hmm.
and the guy doesn't respond, and so he immediately grabs him. And so that dominating form of engagement seems to be at least part of what's getting him into trouble here. So it is a disturbing question, though. Live bait.
Yeah. Like I said, I found this one a difficult one to analyze because there's not a lot of seams where you can pull it apart. And most of what it seems to be cueing the reader into is external to what's actually contained within the short story.
I like the ideas that you brought up. You said it took you a while to kind of work your way around this one and to delve into it, but that was productive.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. No, I don't have any last thoughts or questions, I don't think, except I am kind of grateful that I haven't had to deal with somebody messing with my laundry.
Aren't we all?
I think so. All right, well, the unreliable narrators are Amanda Patchen and Brent Towle. And, as Gene Wolfe said, it seems to me that you can almost define civilization by saying it's people who are not willing to hurt other people because the other people are different.